Previously on Beta.
There's some people who think that LSD is the greatest gift to mankind since Tutti Frutti ice cream. But there are many others who feel that LSD is bad news.
We're basically goldfish, except instead of discovering a new castle in our bowl every 9 seconds, we find something new to be outraged about online.
Now here's that well-known and better-loved family of radio, the Carter family.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, singer-songwriter Carlene Carter talks about combining country music with rock and roll.
I wanted to be the rockiest country female act that there was ever. I turned cartwheels across the stage. I would fly myself out into the audience, and hopefully they'd catch me. Most of the time they did.
And comedian Josh Gondelman shares his unique comedic sensibility.
Not a ton of people come at comedy from the point of view of, like, a slightly frazzled substitute teacher, I guess, is what I sound like.
But first, T.C. Boyle. He's just published his 17th novel. It's called Outside Looking In. As in many of his previous books, a real-life person shows up in the story. This time around, it's Timothy Leary, the man who encouraged people to tune in, turn on, and drop out. So what exactly is Outside Looking In all about?
Well, obviously, this is a book about expanding your consciousness, and that is getting out of your body. And since Timothy Leary is sort of the presiding genius and motivating factor for the book, I was going back to the Moody Blues. Timothy Leary's dead. No, no, he's outside looking at them.
Why did you want to write about this particular subject and this particular time in American history?
First of all, you may recall that I wrote a book called Drop City, published in 2003, and it was my reflections on the hippie movement in the late 60s, which was my time. Could we go back to the earth? Was that viable? Was that a good idea? And that book begins with an acid trip. Now, in recent years, there has been some press about the fact that LSD is coming back into favor with the medical profession, as it had been before Leary and Kesey and some of the others let it loose in society and it became banned. With that in mind, I felt I'd like to go back to a time before Drop City, before my time. And this book is very narrowly in a window of time from 62 to 64. And it deals with Timothy Leary when he was a respected psychologist at Harvard, and his discovery of psilocybin first and then LSD, and he's becoming a kind of messiah for it among his students, and fairly well requiring his students to have this mind-opening experience with him. I'd wanted to see how we got to Jimi Hendrix and that coat with the eyeballs on it, you know?
Yeah. And as you mentioned, LSD and other hallucinogenics have been in the news quite a bit over the past few years. And Michael Pollan and Ayelet Waldman have written books about the positive effects that microdoses of LSD and other hallucinogenics can have. Mm-hmm. Have you had similar experiences?
I only knew macrodoses of street drugs.
Mm.
And my knowledge of this is memorial because we are going now back to my 20s. And my experiences were somewhat pleasurable at first. I put my time in a long time ago.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
And I am not interested in that drug personally because I never had good experiences. I think it's because my mind is so active anyway as a novelist.
Mm. And you only write when you're sober. I've read that. So obviously, from what you've told me, you didn't suddenly make an exception for Outside Looking In and become a method novelist, Marlon Brando style, and write the new novel under the influence of acid.
My drug times were rather severe.
Yeah.
Once I discovered my métier in life, and that is to do what I'm doing now, that is to produce a body of literature for my own purpose and to try to figure out what our animal species is doing on this planet. I shut the door on all of that for the most part because I was absolutely dead serious about what I wanted to do, and I would not mess with that.
You touched on it briefly, but can you give us kind of more of a summary of the storyline of Outside Looking In without revealing any spoilers?
What really fascinated me was how the students would fall under the aegis of their professor, in this case, Timothy Leary. I wondered, what would it have been like if my mentor had been somebody who wanted me to open up to drugs?
Mm.
And so I'm writing this from the perspective of a fictional student of Leary. He's a guy in his 30s. He's gone to graduate school at Harvard. He's worked hard as a school psychologist to pay for it and to get into college. And he comes from a long line of Irish drunks, and he does not want to mess with it. But there is a lot of societal pressure, and both he and his wife fall under the spell of this coterie and become part of Leary's group, which then goes to Zihuatanejo in Mexico for summer experiments. And finally, after Leary was declared persona non grata at Harvard, to Millbrook in New York, where one of Leary's acolytes, very, very wealthy, had given him a 64-room mansion to conduct his experiments with his communal arrangement of all of his students, hangers-on, and so on.
Yeah. Leary is a big presence in your book, and this is the guy that Richard Nixon described as the most dangerous man in America. So I'm curious about what it was like for you to try to inhabit Leary's mind.
Well, I don't inhabit Leary's mind at all. In fact, this is entirely from the point of view of the main characters. That is, Fitzhugh Loney, the grad student, and his wife, Joni. Leary is... he is the presence, though, that motivates all this. And I really enjoyed writing about him because I knew him when I was an addled, drug-addled, a tripping hippie myself, as this preposterous clown on TV in a robe, muttering, and obviously, you know, an acid freak and his brain gone dead. But now I went back to see him as he was. He was 41 when this novel opens. He was handsome, dynamic, charismatic, and one of the hot young psychologists in America. And that's how I portray him. But again, as in any cult, what does it cost you to follow a leader blindly? That's sort of what I've written about in this book and in several other books, like The Inner Circle, for instance, about Alfred C. Kinsey and his influence on his inner circle. And The Women, about Frank Lloyd Wright. What was it like to be an apprentice of his?
That raises this whole question about that you often write about small communities in your novels. That's true of this new one, The Terranauts, your previous one, and many other novels like World's End, Drop City, The Women, and The Road to Wellville. What is it about microcosmic societies that you find so compelling?
I think it's easier to take the problems of society in microcosm. In the way of a playwright, for instance, you don't need a cast of thousands necessarily. Everything wants to be concentrated. And if you put some people in a small arena together, maybe some interesting things will result, not to mention fireworks and drugs and sex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt from Outside Looking In, and if you could set it up, that would be much appreciated.
Yes, I'd be delighted. I describe a couple of trips in this book, and it's difficult to describe a trip in the way that it's difficult to describe a dream without making it rather dull. The first two trips that Fitzhugh takes are relatively happy and sort of deliriously fun. This one is slightly different. If to this point everything had been familiar, right down to Tim showing him the pill bottle and even the cardboard box it came in, Delicid, LSD-25, it read across the label, physician's sample, and below it, in capital letters, poison. Nothing beyond that felt even remotely recognizable. The lights dimmed. Tim switched the record to some sort of repetitive Indian music, a raga, somebody said, which was nothing but a nagging presence that went on nagging for what seemed like an eternity. And then the drug began to come on, rolling through him like waves mounting successively along an infinite beach. Joni was there, and then she wasn't, vanished into her own world. Things began to move, but in no delicate way, not the way it had been the last time, but violently, in screaming ribbons of color, all of it slicing at him till everything visible was sucked down inside him in a free fall that would not and could not end. There was no sex, no touching, no bodies. He was all mind, and his mind was a very rough customer, pounding his consciousness into submission, stingy with the glory, stingier with the heights, showing only what he'd suppressed all his life for the very good and excellent reason that to see it, know it, feel it in his innermost being would destroy him. Images slammed down like heavy sashes, shutting one after the other, only to open up on the next and the next after that. Control, a joke. Personality, a hoax. And schizophrenia, the only realistic outcome, because they didn't call these drugs psychomimetics for nothing, did they? Of course, he was losing his mind, and what other result could he have expected? He was scared, only that, terrified. And if someone was there pushing down on him, Tim, with hands of stone, Tim murmuring, "Don't fight it, just let go, it's going to be all right, all right, all right." It meant nothing to him. There was no God. That was the bedrock certainty of everything he knew. But he prayed to him now, "Our Father, who art in heaven," the cant of his Catholic youth come back to him till he was staring into the slit eyes of the devil, some devil, all the devils, and the void that preceded consciousness and would ineluctably snuff it out, absorbing him into its pure black nothingness, whether his eyes were open or not. Somebody said that he'd been outside, running, that he'd stripped off his jacket and pants and slammed so hard into the inanimate world that there were bruises up and down his legs and a gash just above his right hip that might or might not need bandaging. But he didn't believe a word of it, because when he thought about it very hard, when he really concentrated, he knew he hadn't been there at all.
Fitz's bad trip makes me think of one of my favorite J.G. Ballard quotes, "The ultimate dystopia is the inside of one's own head." Do you think that might be an accurate way to describe what a bad acid trip feels like?
I very much like the quote from Ballard. Yes, of course. What interests me in this book, too, is the notion of God. The first and last lines of the text, exclusive of the prelude, both referenced God, and you heard a reference to it here as well. These drugs are known as entheogens. That is, they allow you to see God. And what the drugs do is they edit out the controlling mind that in turn edits out all the detro impressions rushing into us at all times. Otherwise, we would be schizophrenic. This cuts that down to the more basic snake brain, and we then are susceptible to all sorts of natural rushes of nature through our five senses. Is that God? And also, you know, we see the texts of the great religions of the Quran and the Bible and so on, and even of their latter iterations in, Mormonism and so on. Uh-huh. These are clearly constructed by human beings almost as if they are novels. But is God just some miswiring of the brain? Is it just this concept, just some impression? I wondered about that, and so I pursued it through the book to find out.
Timothy Leary is just the latest actual person to appear in one of your novels. The Women has Frank Lloyd Wright and the four women that he had relationships with. The Road to Wellville has John Harvey Kellogg, the inventor of cornflakes. These are just a few examples. Why do you like to include real people in your novels?
There are no rules in writing a novel. I could have Frank Lloyd Wright, be captured by Martians if I want. But that's not what interests me. I am fascinated by things I discover about history. The Road to Wellville, for instance, John Harvey Kellogg. Well, why do we eat cornflakes? What was the health food movement like? These figures in history who weren't necessarily the generals, but who completely revolutionized what we do and who we are today. And the stories I discover are innately fascinating to me, and I want to give them to you whole cloth so that, for instance, if you'd never heard of Frank Lloyd Wright and you read The Women, all of the facts about him are true. Mm-hmm. And that is true of this book, Outside Looking In, as of the others. And I want to give it to you in that way because it amazes me. And then, of course, as a novelist, my job is to inhabit the minds of the characters around him. What do they think of this?
Mm-hmm. In your previous novel, The Terranauts, you have eight scientists living together in a biodome. So we could say that they're on the inside looking out. And in this novel, people are on the outside looking in and altering their minds with LSD. Is there any significance to this, or am I just barking up the wrong tree with this question?
Oh, I love it, Doug. Absolutely love it.
Okay, great.
And it's true. It is true.
Yeah.
And so The Terranauts gave rise in a way to this book, which I had toyed with calling The Psychonauts, because this is what such explorers are called.
Yeah.
But ultimately I decided to make it its own separate work altogether and not reference the previous one.
Yeah, that would be a good title. And I think you used the word a couple times in the book,
yes.
Don't you? Yes, yeah. You're celebrating 40 years of publishing short stories and books this year. At least I hope you are. You are celebrating, aren't you?
I'm celebrating at this very moment because I love talking with you about the new book.
Yeah. Outside Looking In is your 17th novel. Was there a specific creative challenge that you set for yourself with this book?
There is with all of them, of course. And mm-hmm. in this one, probably to take my own experiences of the past and try to get a perspective on the history involved, which, of course, we didn't know. We thought that we had invented LSD and tripping and sex and everything else. But in fact, we hadn't.
Mm-hmm. What is the best music to drop acid by? I'm inclined to think it might be T.C. Boyle's version of Screamin' Jay Hawkins, I Put a Spell on You. What do you think?
So when I'm working, I am listening to classical music, and I am listening to the jazz of my youth, John Coltrane, who's adduced in this book.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm not, I am purely listening to rock and roll, which I love. So the rock and roll of the era is coming out of acid and reflecting it. And this is another thing I wondered about. It's not really reflected in the book, but if Albert Hofmann, who, by the way, opens the book in a little set piece about his first trip ever.
Yeah.
If he hadn't come up with this, how would the evolution of the 60s have gone if there were no such thing as acid? Well, there was marijuana, there was hashish, we had heroin, we had everything else. But it was something about this particular fungus that does something to our brain chemistry that allowed that efflorescence of the 60s to happen, I think.
T.C. Boyle is the author of Outside Looking In. You can find out more about T.C. on our website, wpr.org/beta.
I think the thesis, if there was one, of my comedy is, yikes, this is pretty rough, but I think we can do better.
Comedian Josh Gondelman on his optimistic stand-up work. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Josh Gondelman's fellow comedians call him the nicest man in comedy. He's just released his third stand-up album. It showcases Josh's kind, gentle sense of humor and includes a number of jokes about his pug, Busy. The album's called Dancing on a Weeknight. What does the title mean?
It's like fun, but it's not outrageous in mm-hmm. any way. Mm-hmm. I think it's just very like, it's kind of like a mostly wholesome good time that, like, you know, maybe it leads into other things, maybe it doesn't, but it's the idea of just like dancing on a weeknight is just like slightly outside of what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, a little outside one's comfort zone. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're taking a bit of a risk, a small risk, but a risk nonetheless.
Right.
Yeah.
But all the, really what that means is like, The follow-up is like sleepy on a work day.
Yeah, maybe that'll be the next album, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How has your comedic voice developed over the years that you've been doing stand-up?
I think it's gotten a little closer to how I see the world. And I think I've gotten better able to be more like myself and more like the ways I can be funny off stage while I'm on stage. Like, I'm also doing less saying stuff because it's funny and gets a laugh, and more saying stuff that's like, oh, I would like to talk about this. Like, this is an idea or an experience I have, and I wonder if I can put that through some kind of filter and turn it into comedy, rather than like, I have this thought, I said it, people laugh at it, so it stays in the hour.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, yeah. So how would you describe your comedic worldview?
I would say it is like optimistic with an acknowledgement that things are bad. So like, I think that the thesis, if there was one, of my comedy is like, yikes, this is pretty rough, but like, I think we can do better.
Yeah.
Again, it's not we're going to have a wild night out tonight. It's not I'm saying what we're all thinking. It's just like, hey, let's give it our best, guys.
Yeah.
Which is like, I think not a ton of people come at comedy from the point of view of like a slightly frazzled substitute teacher, I guess is what I sound like.
Yeah, that's right. Because you taught preschool 4-year-olds?
I did. I taught 4-year-olds for a number of years.
Yeah. So how did teaching 4-year-olds, how has that influenced, or I guess the question more is, has it influenced your approach to stand-up in any way?
I think when you teach kids, there's like a very gentle level of sarcasm and like darkness that you can get away with when you talk to them that flies slightly over their heads.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's like a fun place to be. Like, I used to teach, and I would always get tasked with sitting with the like 3- and 4-year-old girls that were just throwing unimpeachable, unassailable tantrums, and just sitting with them and just going, I know it's so hard. I know life is really complicated sometimes. And it's just like a thing that is both true and sarcasm.
Yeah. I love the fact that you used unimpeachable there in association with the tantrums.
Yeah, just like a tantrum that is like an imperturbable frenzy that's just like, it's like trying to soothe a tornado.
Yeah. That's a great image. Yeah. I especially enjoyed the bits on the new album where you talk about your dog, Busy. Can you tell me a bit about Busy?
Yeah, so Busy is she's about to turn 12.
Oh,
she's
wow.
A 12-year-old, almost 12-year-old pug. If you can't picture a pug from the name of the breed, it's kind of like a furry little cloud that's too fat to fly. If that doesn't do it for you, she looks like a loaf of white bread with a face smushed onto the front slice and a butt smushed onto the back slice. And if you've never hung out with a pug before, it's kind of like if that loaf of bread came some of the way to life. That's her vibe. She's got the energy level of most yogurt, if that. She has like the pug traits of always wanting to kind of be right up in your business, but she's not. I think a lot of pugs are like kind of persistent, like kissers and lickers, and Busy is not. Mm. She has like a very pretty woman, no kissing attitude. And so she's just like a very funny, she's like having a little grumpy roommate around. And when there's stuff that she wants from you, like she wants treats and you don't want to give her treats, or if you haven't noticed that she wants treats yet, she will jump like right up in front of your face, like sit on your lap and then sneeze in your face. And it's like, intentional. And it is like very funny and sometimes very annoying, but she's just like the cutest little cloud of a dog.
Yeah. She sounds like a great dog. Yeah. There's a great moment on the album where you deal with a heckler, and it's very, very effective the way you deal with that heckler. How do you handle hecklers in general?
Oh, my gosh. So it was really back and forth with whether to include that moment, because it's not that common to get heckled. And this was kind of the most common kind of heckle that you get, is just someone who thinks that they have something to add.
A law firm? I like mine better. I'll tell you what, if you have any other alternate punchlines over the course of the evening, just write them down on a little piece of paper, walk to the Gowanus Canal, and throw the paper into it. But I'm glad you're here.
I didn't want to include it because my response got a big laugh.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to put forth or propound the notion that, like, hecklers help the show or, like, lead to better comedy,
mm-hmm.
because I would rather not do mm-hmm. that. Ultimately, I think Dominic Del Bene, who is the guy, the head of the label Blonde Medicine that I'm putting out the album with, really found it kind of convinced me. He thought it was, like, a fun, charming, like, live moment.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you did it because it is a great moment. Do you have a favorite bit or a favorite joke on the new album that you're particularly proud of?
Oh, that's a great question. I really like talking about Maris in an affectionate, admiring way.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, because that's how I feel about her. And it's very fun as a challenge to create comedy out of that. And so I feel very proud of being able to achieve that.
Before we were married, back when we were engaged, people would ask my then fiance, now wife, all the time, right in front of me, if she was going to take my last name, which is a little presumptuous and it's a little sexist, right? Because no one ever asked me if I was going to give it to her, huh? If I was just going to let her embrace the poetry that is Gondelman into her life every day forever.
I mean, there are people in very loving marriages with that make a lot of great comedy out of conflict,
mm-hmm.
but it's just like that's not, to me, the central experience of being married. And it's still a fairly new marriage. We've only been married about 2 years next month, or exactly 2 years next month. But I don't think it will get into like, ugh, the old ball and chain.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think like to speak about being married like that does a disservice to specifically to my wife, but it's also like, why would I do that when I can like scratch a little harder and get to the like, how do I really feel about this? Like, what do I want to say? And like, it's fun to express different kinds of feelings and different kinds of like foibles that are based in my own brain rather than like, she said this and I said that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, for sure, definitely. The Village Voice in one piece and in a story about you, they described you as a high-functioning neurotic. What does that mean to you? First of all, do you agree with that? Do you agree with that description?
It's a very sweet and very fun way to describe me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm that neurotic. Drew Grant at The Observer years ago, when I co-wrote a book with my friend Joe Berkowitz,
yeah.
and Drew described me in – I think a piece about that as a pathological sweetheart. And I feel like that is something that's always stuck in my mind,
yeah.
where it's not that I'm neurotic and functioning in spite of it. It's that like my specific pathology has me locked into like unfailing politeness, even when there is no reason to be polite,
yeah.
and kind of a unflagging cheeriness even when there's no reason to be cheerful.
Yeah, exactly. That, well said, yeah. And you're frequently described as the nicest man in comedy as well.
That's very kind, and it's very nice to have that reputation, and I try to be nice. I think there are other very nice people, but I think I might not be the nicest, but I'm definitely very friendly, and I think mm-hmm. friendly reads as nice when, like, kind of quiet and supportive otherwise doesn't outwardly play as nice all the time, especially when someone's act is a little grittier than mine. And I think, like, because my act is also very cheerful and pleasant, that I reap the benefits of that. People conflate that with who I am off stage, which is, like, very close to the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. You and your friend Jack Moore came up with what is one of the most brilliant Twitter accounts ever back around 2012, and I'm not using hyperbole here. It's called Modern Seinfeld. Can you tell me about Modern Seinfeld?
Sure. So we haven't done it in a while, but the premise was, like, what would be little plot threads if Seinfeld were still on the air? And just because so much of it was based in, like, little etiquette customs and kind of, like, technological snafus, like answering machine messages.
Yeah.
And there was just so much of it that felt like if you lived through that time, it still plays. I had tweeted a couple things about Modern Seinfeld plot lines just from my own account. And Jack was like, you know, this could really be a thing. And so he staked out the handle at Seinfeld Today. And then we just kind of wrote that for a while. And it was, very flattering that people liked it.
Do you have a few favorite Modern Seinfeld tweets?
I think my favorite one was Elaine is hooking up with a neighbor in her building. And then when she breaks it off, he makes his Wi-Fi network name an insult about her so that everyone in the building can see it.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, like Elaine is a jerk or something, and then won't change it.
A couple of my favorites are the one about Kramer renting out his apartment every night on Airbnb and living in the hallway, and Kramer says, "I'm making cash hand over fist," Jerry, and Jerry says, "You're homeless." That's a great one, too, yeah. You managed to parlay your Twitter account into a comedy career. How did you do that?
So I'd already been doing stand-up for a number of years by the time, of course, there's no way to do stand-up for a non-number of years.
Yeah.
But I'd already been doing stand-up for, I guess, 7-ish years, seriously, maybe 8, by the time that happened. So when the Twitter account exploded kind of basically overnight, we got these opportunities. People wanted to talk to us about things. They wanted to hear pitches for stuff. And I was, like, slightly unprepared. I, like, didn't have a lot of scripts ready to go, hey, staff me on this show. Here's my writing sample. Mm-hmm. But it did start getting me in the mix for late-night TV jobs. I was able to submit writing packets for those that were topical and that didn't rely on, like, okay, I have a feature-length film that I've worked on for years, and here it is now that I have these opportunities. So I did, after the Modern Seinfeld Twitter kind of blew up, I applied to writing jobs basically for a year, thanks to the, like, a little bit of industry attention and validation that came from that. And I did a little work for Billy on the Street in the summer of 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got hired at the beginning of 2014 to do the digital social stuff for Last Week Tonight with John Oliver as that show was launching. And I did that for a year and then was moved over mostly to write for the show, the second season. And I wrote there for 4 years. So I was there for half a decade, which is, like, truly wild to me. I never thought that could happen. I truly, when I started doing stand-up, did not ever really think, like, oh, I'm going to get to work at a show that I'm really proud of with people that are really great, and for such a sustained period of time. It just, like, didn't feel, you know, because I would watch, like, The Daily Show in high school and college and think, like, man, what a cool thing that is. And then I got to work in that field.
Why did you choose to leave Last Week Tonight to go work with Deezus and Merrill?
It was just a really exciting opportunity that came up to work on a new show that was launching with people that I think are so funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt very different in terms of what the show would be like and what the and their comedic voice. And so I was really excited to move and have kind of different responsibilities at a different show that I also felt really psyched about. And so I don't think I would have, you know, I wasn't, like, clawing at the walls to leave. I would have been very happy coming back for another season.
Mm-hmm.
But right as the season was ending, I got asked to interview for the show, and it just seemed like a really fun next thing to work on. And I'm really enjoying it, and the guys are so funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, again, going from, like, one super over-the-moon dream job to another one, and which has been a great privilege.
Look, Josh, how you feeling about your team this year?
Don't matter.
I feel good. When did they win that championship on your hat?
Yankees. Oh! Yo, Josh is talking spicy!
Damn, Josh, how you gonna get unemployed the same year the Yankees win? Crazy. It's crazy.
As you alluded to, Last Week Tonight follows kind of a more traditional late-night model, while Deezus and Merrill is more unconventional, more freeform, so to speak. Did you have to develop a different comedic voice and kind of comedic timing to work on this show?
It is very different. It's mostly, like, structurally different, where instead of writing as many super precise jokes, it's a lot about writing incredibly clear, clean copy that leads Deezus and Merrill into the kind of improvisation they're doing. And then it's writing a lot more sketches, pitching more like silly ideas to do in the field, man on the street stuff. And that was one of the things that I think was appealing to me, was that I wasn't going to be moving and writing the same kind of show in a different voice, but it would be like fully flexing different muscles, or like developing different muscles. And I'm very I'm like really enjoying learning how to build up those skills too.
Josh Gondelman is a stand-up comedian. He's also a writer and producer for Desus and Mero on Showtime. His latest album is called Dancing on a Weeknight. You can find out more about Josh on our website, wpr.org/beta.
That's what my grandmother's wish was, is that we would keep the music alive always. And so as a young kid, that's what I was told. When we're all gone, you have to make sure to keep the music alive.
Up next, Carlene Carter honors her country music heritage, June Carter Cash, and the Carter family. I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Carlene Carter was born with country music running in her veins. She's the daughter of country music stars June Carter and Carl Smith, and she's the granddaughter of Maybelle Carter of the Carter family. We talked to Carlene backstage at the Stoughton Opera House before her show, and it was quite a show. Carlene may not be turning cartwheels on stage anymore, but she's still full of energy, and her voice might be better than it's ever been. Carlene, your latest album is called Carter Girl, and it was released in 2014, and all 12 of the songs were written by or co-written by a member of the Carter family. Most of them were composed by your great uncle, A.P. Carter. And the website AllMusic said that, quote, Carlene Carter has confronted the mighty legacy of the Carter family songbook and allowed it to strengthen her music rather than buckling under its weight, end quote. So I'm curious, did you feel a lot of pressure to honor your family's legacy while you were recording this album?
No, not at that point. But, you know, years ago, when I knew I was going to do this album someday, but I always felt like while the Carters were still alive, while my aunts and my mom, Helen and Anita and June, were still alive, that they were doing that, and I didn't need to do that. And then when Mom passed away, I didn't want to do one of those things where somebody dies and you go off and do a Carter family album and cash in on the grief or something. Honestly, it hurt too bad to sing the music right after she died. So I waited until I was able to make those songs mine and embrace them and not be thinking that I had to do them exactly the way that they had done it or exactly the way Helen, Anita, and June did it. Because there was a lot of different Carter family phases out of three generations. There really are. But I really lucked out when I got Don Was involved in the project. I said, I really want this to be they play with me. I want to be able to play all these songs, just me and the guitar, and then I want everything else to be gravy on it. And that's exactly what happened. And it was the first time I'd ever, like, played all my guitar parts live and all my vocals live.
Yeah, it's interesting that you got Don Was to produce it because, of course, he was the leader of the 1980s funk rock band Was Not Was, and he's produced a slew of artists like Bonnie Raitt, Willie Nelson, Iggy Pop. How did Don influence the sound of the album?
We had lots of conversations about it, and I made lots of lists of different songs. I wanted to find some that were really well-known, but then some that weren't so well-known. And I also wanted to just let the band kind of come in and make it just a little bit more jazzy or whatever, or, you know, more contemporary. And Don is just, he's a bass player, he's a musician, he's very lyrical in his playing. As Jim Keltner, the drummer on it, the great Jim Keltner, he's very lyrical in his playing. So it went really well with the music. So Don is just like, he's all about like trying to get what's in your head of how you want it to sound. And so I remember after the first song we cut was Little Black Train, and he goes, okay, now I get what we're going to do.
Yeah.
But he's just like that. And, you know, I trusted him completely. And I waited for him to be available because I just had a gut feeling that he was the right person. Because I didn't want it to be like just Carlene singing a bunch of Carter family songs.
Yeah.
You know, it had to be that way.
So you mentioned Little Black Train. Tell me a bit about that, why you chose to do that song.
You know, it's a spiritual song. I never had heard it before, which is so bizarre. But when I started researching the Carter family music, there was like 700 songs. And I never realized there were quite that many. So I ended up getting in the Shadow Clinch Mountain, the box set of the Carter family, the original recordings. And I went through them and I looked through the book and I looked at lyrics and titles. And I didn't listen to the music until I saw something that I wanted to sing about. And that's how I picked stuff.
There's a little black train coming. Set your business right. There's a little black train coming. And it may be here tonight. Go tell that bald lady. All dressed in the world of pride. The Death Star train is coming. Better take every ride.
You know, I had a lot of ambition about doing the record in the sense that I wanted to honor my aunts. I wanted to do a song that Helen had written. I wanted to do a song that Anita was very well known for singing. I wanted to do a song that Mom had written. And I managed to do that. And I also managed to stick a couple of songs in there that I wrote. All the songs say that they were written by A.P. Carter. Most of the Carter family songs do. But the reality of it is because of the times back then, you know, he was the head patriarch. My grandma and my Aunt Sarah were very instrumental in the creating of these songs as well. You know, AP would go out and find songs. He'd go knock on somebody's front porch door and say, hey, you got any songs your grandma taught you? And that's how a lot of things would come. And then he would, like, hone them up. But grandma told me, I said, so what did you do mainly? She said, he'd bring home scraps of paper, and I just make up a little tune for it. And so... that's the sweetest thing when I think about Grandma being so young and doing that.
You recorded a new version of one of your signature songs, Me in the Wildwood Rose for Carter Girl. And this is a beautiful song in which you share childhood memories of your grandparents, Maybelle and Ezra, as well as your half-sister, Rosie Nix Adams, who passed away in 2003. Why did you want to re-record the song?
Because it meant more to me than it did when I wrote it in 1990. I think I wrote it in 1989, but it came out in 1990. It meant even more because they had all passed away, and Rosie as well had passed away. So it was my honoring them, all of them, that had, you know, made me who I am. And so my cousin Lori and I, we're the girls that are left that sing. And then there's other generations coming down, like my daughter, Tiffany, and I've got granddaughters that are interested in it. So it's cool, you know. And that's what my grandmother's wish was, is that we would keep the music alive always. And so as a young kid, that's what I was told. When we're all gone, you have to make sure to keep the music alive. And that was drilled in me. And not in a mean way, or it's like, we got a responsibility here. The most refreshing thing I think about this music for me was the fact that it is timeless. Some of those things were written a very long time ago, and they still apply to today.
To my ears, this version of Me and the Wildwood Rose has a much more melancholy, poignant feel to it.
Yeah, it's a lot more emotional to sing.
In my grandma's house, her children would sing. Guitars are twanging and their laughter would ring. I was little, but I was the biggest kid. I wanted to do what the grown-ups did. In an epic shiny car, we'd head down the road, sing for the miners who brought out the coal many a time. Slept on the floorboards cold, on a quilt, my little sister, the Wildwood Rose.
Let's rewind back to 1990, which is when you released your most commercially successful album, I Fell in Love. You had four hit singles from this album, including the title track, which features some great frenetic fretwork from the legendary Albert Lee. Can you tell me a bit about this song?
Well, actually, I can tell you the truth about the song is that I had been working with Howie Epstein, and, you know, who's from Milwaukee.
Yes, and, thank you.
And the late, great Howie Epstein. I did not want a boyfriend. I did not want to fall in love with a producer. I didn't want to fall in love with a bass-playing producer like I had married before.
Yes, Nick Lowe,
you know,
yes.
Nick.
Yeah.
But I remember saying to one of my best friends, Kathy Valentine, I said, you know that Howie Epstein? She goes, yeah. And I said, I think I like him. And I remember thinking, I fell in love. And then I said, what you want to do that for? And I just had this vision of it being like this real sing-along thing from in the audience.
Yeah.
And it was also really fun and you know, kind of taking the mickey out of things.
Howie produced this album and then co-produced your next too, so mm-hmm. he played a big role in this revival, if we can
he
call
did.
It
and,
that.
You know, we were learning how to make those kind of records together in a way,
yeah.
because he made a lot of records, but not as a producer. He produced a little bit, but not very much, and one of the reasons why we kept our relationship kind of quiet and on the down low was because we didn't want people to go, oh, he's only producing her because he's her boyfriend,
yeah.
or, you know, any of that kind of
yeah,
bull.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were together a very long time, and eventually we weren't able to work together. He just butted heads too much. And
yeah.
I just said, we can either be boyfriend and girlfriend or we can work together. He was a taskmaster. You know, perfectionist. It shows in the records. They're really, really tight and really good. And we had a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it comes through. It's a lot. They're a lot of fun.
And
to
it was
listen
exciting
to.
Because the first thing when we did, I Fell in Love. The guys that played on it, the original guys, Benmont, Albert, Howie, Jim Keltner was on it in the beginning. He came and did a drum machine for it, and
oh,
they
really?
All did it on spec. And that's what got me my record deal, was four songs that are on I Fell in Love. That's what got Warner Brothers interested in me again. Also the fact that I said, okay, guys, I think I owe you a record that you might get on the radio. And I'm country now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah,
they
exactly.
never really knew what to do with me. It's like I was kind of like a little too rockin'. A little too rockin' for country.
Right, that's which is on. What I wanted to ask you about, because my introduction to your music was your third album, Musical Shapes, which mm-hmm. was produced by your husband-to-be, Niccolo, and featured his band Rockpile on most of the album, Dave Edmunds, Billy Bremner, and Terry Williams. One critic described this album as perhaps the greatest fusion of rock and country since the days of rockabilly. Well, you were obviously intentionally trying to combine rock
we
and
were.
Country.
Yeah, you know, Rockpile were perfect for it. Really, Musical Shapes was the record I went to England to make. And it all fell together. And the reason it did work is because by that point, I had known these guys for a good long while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like we were just thrown in the room and they were going, oh, do you know George Jones?
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah.
That's the first thing Dave Evans ever said to me.
Excuse my stand.
Was this rocking out kind of like, was it in some way kind of a rebellion against your country music heritage at
no.
all? Or it's just what you were interested in?
It's just my body.
Yeah.
I mean, I just like had to go. I
yeah.
just, you know, I always just like had a lot of energy and I wanted to be, and I actually set out to do it in the 90s. I wanted to be the rockinest country female act that there was ever. I turned cartwheels across the stage. I would fly myself out into the audience, and hopefully they'd catch me. Most of the time they did. I had a few boo-boos. My son one time said, going, Mom, get up.
Yeah.
That's when I can't. But, yeah, we, some fun times. But
yeah.
It also took a toll on me physically because I was so animated. I was in incredible shape. Now, these days, it's like I still move and everything, but it's like I'm a little bit more mellow at 63.
Music critic Bill Friscus Warren has said that you're a lot like Emmylou Harris in the sense that you are both roots music renaissance women who can do it all. What do you think of that description?
Wow, that is an amazing compliment.
Yeah.
Wow, I just got cold chills from that because Emmy is my hero.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're probably her hero.
Oh, well, I don't know. But I was really, the last tour I did with Mellencamp, I put Emmy's name in the hat. And she came out and did it with us.
Oh, cool.
And that was fantastic because I'd always wanted to be on tour with her. And then recently we did the Keamo cruise. My band and I went down and did that. And Emmylou was on it as well.
Oh, great.
And for the first time I got to sing She sang with me on Easy From Now On.
Oh, cool. The final track on I Fell In Love.
Yeah, which is the song that I wrote for her that she recorded in 1978.
Fantastic, yeah.
It's gonna be
Carlene Carter is a country music singer and songwriter. Her latest album is called Carter Girl. You can find out more about Carlene at WPR.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
You don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle.
Our technical and music director is Steve Gotcher.
You just did the most acid I've ever seen anybody eat in my life.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
He said he understood, but I could see in his eyes that he didn't.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Well, Dr. Leary, I find your product boring.